This meeting of the House Judiciary Committee will now come to order. The time is now 1:25 p.m., Friday, February 14th, 2025, and we are meeting in the Max Grunberg Room, Capitol Room 120. The following members are present: Representative Costello, Representative Mina, Representative Underwood, Representative Eichheit, Representative Vance, Vice Chair Kopp, and myself, Representative Gray, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Before we begin, I'd like to ask everyone to please silence their cell phones. I also want to take a moment to thank Sophia Tenney from House Records, Susan Quigley from the Juno LIO, and my committee aide, Nate Graham, for staffing the committee today. Your work is greatly appreciated. We have one item for business before the committee today, a presentation from Brad Meerstall with the University of Alaska Anchorage Justice Center on crime trends in Alaska. Dr. Brad Meerstall, chair of the Justice Center and a leading researcher in criminal justice, received his PhD from Indiana University and specializes in policing, exploring how interactions with law enforcement shape public perceptions. The University of Alaska Anchorage Justice Center was established by the Alaska Legislature in 1975 to provide statewide justice-related education, research, and service. As an interdisciplinary unit within the College of Health, the center offers undergraduate and professional education, conducts research on crime, law, and justice, and provides services to government agencies, justice organizations, and community partners across both urban and rural Alaska. Through its education, research, and outreach efforts, the UAA Justice Center plays a vital role in promoting a safe, healthy, and just society across Alaska. Welcome, Dr. Meerstall. Please take yourself off mute, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation.
Okay, before I get started, I'll just do a quick audio check.
You sound great.
Okay, great. Thanks, everybody. My name is Brad Meerstall, as was mentioned before by the chair. I am a faculty member here at the UAA Justice Center, and I serve as director of the Alaska Justice Information Center, which is the Justice Center's dedicated research unit. I very much appreciate the committee's invitation to appear before you today, and I'm ready to proceed if you are.
We are ready.
Okay, so crossing fingers for no technical glitches, I'm going to attempt to share my screen. Hopefully, can you see that so far?
Yes, we can see that. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm going to attempt to go into presentation mode, and hopefully that won't throw everything haywire. So I can't really see you, so I guess I'm wondering if you just see, no, you're probably looking at notes. It looks like, hold on. I rehearsed this beforehand, I apologize. Let me try this one more time. So I'll try that, and hopefully this time you're just looking at the title slide.
That looks good, Dr. Meerstall.
Okay, thanks. Okay, we'll just dive right in. Today I'm going to be making a presentation on Alaska crime rate trends from 1985 through 2023. So a bit of a long view to provide the committee with context for where we're at today. My focus primarily, though not exclusively in my presentation today, is going to be on what are known as uniform crime reports data. So briefly here, I'll just go over what those data are and why I've selected those to brief the committee on Alaska's crime picture as it stands. So the Uniform Crime Report Program, it's managed by the FBI, and it was initiated all the way back in 1929. So it gives us almost a century of data. And it is by far the longest ongoing criminological data collection in the U.S. The data contained within the UCR crime reporting program are provided by state, local, tribal, and some limited federal law enforcement agency. And it's important to note the program participation by law enforcement agencies is voluntary, although the vast majority do participate. And it's important to note that some states actually require their state-certified LEAs to participate. So I'm selecting the UCR data not only because it's readily available and it provides such a nice long-term picture of crime volume within specific jurisdictions, but also because UCR data are probably the most frequently cited crime data that's out there sort of in the discourse, in the ether. Certainly, I would say that media sources rely on it, not exclusively, but primarily. And so this presentation today then should dovetail well within sort of common knowledge or expectations about crime rates that you may have read about or heard about before. So within that framework, the UCR crime rates that are most often cited are what's referred to as Part 1 offenses. And an easy way to think about what makes an offense a Part 1 offense is these are generally felony level crimes. Now, that's not a perfect one-to-one, but these tend to be the most serious property and violent crimes, and those are what are measured by the UCR program. The violent crimes I've highlighted in red here on the slide include aggravated assault, robbery, rape, and criminal homicide. And you'll notice the parenthetical following rape on the slide. And this is really important. The FBI changed and expanded the definition of rape beginning in 2013. And as will become clear later in my presentation, it's really important to view rape data within the framework of the UCR as two separate time series, up through 2012 and then 2013 moving forward. So that's a really important note. Within the category of property crimes, I'll be presenting data on larceny thefts, burglary, motor vehicle theft. I will not be presenting data on arson, which was added to the UCR index offenses in 1979. And for those who might want to know what the specific definitions for these crime categories are, they're included at the end of the slide deck as appendices. So what makes the uniform crime reports uniform? Well, it's the standardized crime definitions that the FBI requires all participating jurisdictions to use. And so every state and tribal entity that submits data to the UCR program has to translate their particular criminal statutory framework into these categories. And so for the purposes of sort of comparison and aggregating data at different levels from the state level all the way up into national level crime rate data, we have apples to apples. And last, the UCR program was initiated, again, almost a century ago, really for two primary purposes. One was that so police leaders could gauge the volume of crimes that were coming into their agencies. And then secondly, was to be able to monitor changes in the volume of the volume and or rate of crimes known to police over time. So as you might expect, if you were a chief of police, you would certainly want to know the volume of business coming in through the door. And that was the primary impetus for the formation and development of this program. Okay, so I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this first slide to orient the committee and others who might be listening. And then we'll dive into the substance of the two lines that are presented, the two trends that are presented, and then I'll move on through the rest of the data without having to give a whole lot of exposition about how to interpret the graphics that will be presented to you. So what is displayed on this slide is property and violent crime rates in Alaska for the period beginning 1985 through 2023. If you look down on the bottom of the graph, the horizontal or x-axis, that's where the years are depicted. So there's one bin for every year, ranging from 1985 through 2023. On the vertical axis, it depicts the crime rate. And for this presentation, crime rate is measured as the annual rate per 100,000 population in the state of Alaska. Finally, what is presented here are composites, that is the summing together or the squashing together of the violent crimes that I described previously and the property crimes that I described previously. So what we see on this graph first is a fairly linear decline in property crime rate during the period that's examined. Now, of course, from year to year, there's a bit of variation. We fully expect variation in crime rates, just like we do in most natural phenomenon. But in general, it is a pretty linear trend. And the last 2 to 3 years suggests maybe it's leveling out, but I think it's a little early to make any firm conclusions. Conversely, is the red line. And the red line represents the violent crime composite. And in general, what I would say is that the story here is that it's a flat trend, at least since 1993-ish. It's been pretty steady, some years higher than others, but overall a flat trend. So on the one hand, things aren't necessarily getting worse, but they're not necessarily getting better either. And of course, we did see an increase in Alaska's violent crime rates from 1985 through about 1993. But once we hit the mid-90s, it's pretty much held steady. And I'll just pause because it's hard for me to see you on a and see if there are any questions so far. If not, I will move on to the next slide.
Representative Costello and then Representative Mina.
Thank you very much for your presentation. So I was curious about how the population would actually impact the violent crime rate, because as we know, the population in Alaska has changed since 1985, and I was just curious if that affects the interpretation of this graph.
Through the chair, excellent question. Thank you very much. This provides me an opportunity to clarify here. So the reason we use rates as a per capita measure is it controls for population. So it's a rate per 100,000. And so we actually have apples to apples comparisons from year to year. If I were just to present to you the raw number of violent crimes and property crimes known to police in Alaska over this time, then population would not be included. And then you would need to make some sort of correction or contextualize the data relative to population decline. But as computed, rates are inclusive of population change. So it's a constant conversion that provides you an annual rate per 100,000 of the population as it was in any given year.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, I noticed that there are spikes in the data in the late 80s and the mid-2010s, and those are the same times that Alaska experienced recessions. Do you do any research to correlate recessions and an increase in property crimes?
I don't. I think that's a great question for discussion, and that will be, I think, fleshed out in a little bit more clarity and perhaps might help push the conversation along in some subsequent slides.
Thank you.
I have a question. Dr. Mostal, between 1985 and 1996 or so, it looks like the violent crime rate doubled. And then I know that you said that it holds steady forever after. But do we have any reason why that sort of doubling between 85 and 96?
Thank you for the question. The increase we see through the mid-1980s through the mid-1990s actually mirrors very well national trends. The difference, and we'll talk about this a little bit later in the presentation, is while the rest of the nation sort of regressed to the mean, so there was this crime spike in the through mid-1990s in general across the country. While other jurisdictions saw a recovery, if you will, that is a subsequent decline and regression to the mean, Alaska has remained stubbornly persistent.
No other questions? Please continue.
Okay, thank you. So far, what do we make of one graph with two lines on it? What I would say so far is that you can tell that Alaska's crime rates are something of a mixed bag. The good news is that already we see that at least in the aggregate, property crime rate has fallen by more than half So a decline of 64% between 1985 and 2023. And then there's not so good news, right? And I just mentioned this, violent crime rate has held steady since about 1993. What I would say is, with only one slide under our belt so far in the presentation, we just need to hold tight a little bit on jumping to conclusions, because I think, as you will see, it's helpful to disaggregate these violent crime and property crime composites, and that might help flesh out additional questions as well as perhaps be suggestive of some answers. So if we unpack the property crime rate, and it's depicted here the same as it was in the previous slide with the thick gray line, so that's the composite. And then we have the three component elements that were included in that composite. And again, just a reminder, I did not include arson in this analysis. So what we have here is larceny theft in the bold red line, motor vehicle theft in with the orange thin line with the little X's on it, and then burglary with the thick dashed line. And so what we can see here right off the bat is that if you want to talk about the property crime composite in Alaska, you need to understand that it is dominated almost exclusively by larceny theft, which isn't to necessarily trivialize motor vehicle theft or burglary, certainly. But when you're talking about the volume of crimes known to police in Alaska, it's important to understand that larceny theft within that property crime composite is what's really driving it. In terms of the trends, when we disaggregate here, what we can see is that it's consistent decline, again, with some variability. And you'll notice that sort of the hump in the mid, from about 2015 to right past the pandemic and sort of our post-pandemic reality. But despite the increase, what we're seeing is a return to the trend that was established in the decades previously. Now, if we look at the...
Representative Eichscheid has a question.
Thank you, Chairman Gray. I had a question about that bump in 2017, 2018. I don't know if you were going to talk about that, but any causal factors that you can share, and I'm thinking specifically about Senate Bill 91. I'm just anything you can clarify in that regard, please.
Sure. Through the chair, what I'd say is the first thing, you know, I'm a college professor, and so I have caveats. And while I certainly, you know, I want to make clear, I'm not trying to dodge the question, but what I will say is crime, like all human behavior, is multifaceted, and it's a multivariate, very complex phenomenon. So I would just caution the committee about, you know, identifying any one particular thing, because it's usually almost always a combination of things. With that being said, I think there are some reasonable hypotheses that could be put forward whenever we see a departure from the trend that we saw before. And so if we look at this bump from, say, you know, 2016-17 through 2020, it might be hypothesized, for example, that was sort of, if you recall, kind of the heat of what we were experiencing up here with respect to the opioid epidemic, excuse me. And so then you might ask, okay, if that's the hypothesis, then what would the mechanism be that would influence population level crime rates in this way? And, you know, at that time, you know, I think there were a lot of practitioners and policymakers talking about how the opioid crisis was, you know, leading to an increase in property crimes overall as people were becoming more addicted to those substances, and then seeking to procure other people's properties, including motor vehicles. That's a big part of that uptick that you see there, and those sorts of things. As it relates to a specific piece of legislation, you know, I think it would be really hard to empirically correlate or doc, you know, really have a firm linkage between a singular piece of legislation, as even as complex as it was, to a particular rise in crime, though I'm not saying it's impossible, right? I think at the end of the day, where we come down in AJIC, the Alaska Justice Information Center, is if it's an empirically, you know, if it's possible to empirically explore a question, we're eager to do that, irrespective of what a particular hypothesis would be. I hope that's helpful.
Follow up?
Yes, follow up.
Yeah, just it was very helpful, and through the chair, very helpful. And, you know, I think, you know, my notes, I heard the multivariate nature of crime, and I also heard correlations, not causation. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Please continue.
Chair, are yes. we good to go? Okay.
We're good to go.
All right. So now if we shift to violent crimes and unpack that a little bit, I actually have two sort of violent crime breakouts here for you, is in a similar fashion to the way larceny theft dominates the property crime composite. I think it's really important for committee members and others to understand that if you're talking about the violent crime composite, please know that it is overwhelmingly dominated by volume by aggravated assault. So certainly, and we'll talk about this in just a moment, rape, robbery, and criminal homicide certainly do occur, but notice the difference in magnitude. And that leads me to this next slide, which blows up those last three, because they're on such a different scale. You have to take out aggravated assault and just sort of leave it out so that you can see variability here in the violent crime rates for rape, robbery, and criminal homicide. The first thing I want to draw the committee's attention to is that shaded sort of salmon-colored box to the right-hand side of the graph. This depicts the change in the UCR's definition of rape. Because the UCR expanded the definition of rape, and it expanded it in very broad ways. So don't quote me on the exact language here, but the old, the sort of what's referred to as the legacy definition of rape was the carnal knowledge of a female against her will. Beginning in 2013, the focus, and again, this is reflected in the definitions provided at the end of the presentation. And beginning in 2013, the definition changed to be inclusive of both sexes, so it was not one sex dependent, and shifted the focus to forceful acts of penetration with aspects of the body or foreign objects. And so it was much more inclusive. Consequently, we fully expected a significant increase in the overall rate from 2012 to 2013, and certainly we do see this on the graph. In general, right, what I would say is it's important not, and I probably should have broken this line, again, hindsight is 2020 when giving presentations, because this should not be viewed as one singular trend for rape over time. It should be viewed as two trends over two separate periods of time. So I just wanted to make sure to note that.
Dr. Marcel, we have a question.
Turning,
Representative Vance.
Thank you. I have a few questions about this this graph, and there, regardless of the definition change in 2013, there's still some obvious peaks over time that I think are significant when it comes to rape in Alaska. One, you know, a large climb starting in 1989, then there's another one in, it looks like, 1994, and then a significant one in 2011. Do you have any data on what could have caused, what events took place during that time and that led to those significant peaks prior to the change of the definition?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, what I would say is, first of all, I don't have any data that would speak to what might explain that bit of variance. I think more importantly, what I would say is that is not unusual variance. And so I would just caution committee members from seeing variability as somehow abnormal, that we fully expect variability, some years higher, some years lower. If we begin to see a persistent year over year over year over year decline or increase and see a real change in trend, then that's sort of a different thing. What I would say is, in general, and you're right, it does seem to be sort of a step-fixed increase between the late 80s and then into the 90s. But once we began in the 90s, it is pretty much a flat trend all the way through 2012, with variability upwards and downwards from that mean.
Follow-up. Would you discuss a little bit more about the definition of rape for the UCR and then the updated definition of rape in Alaska that occurred, I believe, in around 2022? And just kind of talk about the basic differences between those two for clarification.
Through the chair, I'm going to be very careful here because I don't have all of the statutory frameworks around sexual assault and sexual abuse of a minor committed to memory for today's presentation. What I will say is that when thinking about how the Uniform Crime Reports operationalizes or defines the nature of rape, and then Alaska's or any other state's statutory framework for sexual assault and inclusive of sexual abuse of a minor, there are sort of very specific rules that the Department of Public Safety, the Anchorage Police Department, Soldotna Police Department, every police department in the state of Alaska that participates, that they have a translation table to be able to work from state statutes and how to categorize, any crime, including rape. And I think it's important to highlight that, you know, that in Alaska we have sexual assault statutes and we have sexual abuse of a minor statutes. And then we have other groups of crimes that are classified as sex offenses. But if you look for the word rape in Alaska statutes, you would be sort of misguided in that way, right? So this is a concept and a term that Alaska and other jurisdictions have to translate their statutes into, if that makes sense.
Follow up. I understand the challenge here, but I feel like my question wasn't really answered. This is really helpful information, and there's a distinction between the UCR definition, but as Alaskan lawmakers, when we're concerned about this issue and making sure that our statutes are relevant in providing justice, I think it's important for us to understand the difference in definition of what we're seeing here and what our Alaska law says. So if you could get back to us on that, because we updated, consent a few years ago when we were woefully behind compared to other states. And I'm just trying to understand the difference in that between this UCR definition, because you've highlighted that had caused a shift in the reporting, what the reporting looks like, which is significant. So help us understand the difference between what we're looking at and the law that we work with.
Sure. So that jump beginning in 2013, so just that jump from 2012 to 2013 would be fully expected, because in this graph, 1985 through 2012, rape could not include a male victim. Beginning in 2013 with the FBI's redefinition, it was not only the carnal knowledge of a female against her will, right? That's the legacy definition. In the updated definition, it is not sex specific in terms of the victim. And it broadened from carnal, limiting it to carnal knowledge of a female, to forcible penetration with parts of the body or foreign objects. So it was much more inclusive of a potential victim population where males were excluded previously. And it widely expanded the offense, sort of the menu of offenses that would be included in the UCR's definition of rape. If I were, you know, again, as a criminologist and not an attorney, what I would say is the change that was made in the UCR definition of rape beginning in 2013 was much more reflective of not only Alaska's statutes, but other states as well. I think everybody would say that the legacy definition of rape was woefully inadequate to capture the volume of rape that was occurring in any jurisdiction.
Thank you. I appreciate the clear explanation of this.
Sure. You're very welcome. So turning to the data that are actually presented in the graph, probably what jumps off your screen, if for no other reason than it's bold black, is the robbery rate. And in general, what we see here is a flat trend with two peaks. And they are distinct peaks. The good news is that, you know, certainly it wasn't good news when Alaska was going through it in the mid-90s and in the mid-teens of this century, but is that we saw a regression to sort of long-term trend, right, hovering right around 75 per 100,000 per year. And again, these are offenses reported to or otherwise known by police. But there was most definitely spikes during these two time periods. The spike in the mid-1990s corresponds with what we saw across the country. And unlike aggravated assault, what we saw is, like the rest of the country, Alaska's robbery rate then regressed to the mean. It went back down after that increase beginning in the late 80s, peaking in the mid-1990s. So that it behaves differently as sort of a criminological phenomenon than aggravated assault. And then we see another spike in robbery, 2015. It started sort of peaking in the 17-18 time period and then coming back down since about 2021. And this maps on, interestingly, with what we talked about in the property crime breakout of sort of that little hump at the end of the time series for property crimes as well. It's important to understand that robbery, of course, is the taking of another person's property. We measure it as a violent crime because of the violent nature of that taking. You know, it's a direct confrontation between a perpetrator and a victim, and it's a forcible taking of properties. So that's why we include it as a violent crime. So that's an interesting little bit. And again, perhaps, you know, I don't want to put this out there as an explanation, but simply as a hypothesis. If we think back to the heat of the opioid epidemic and the dynamics that created in Alaska communities with motor vehicle thefts and all other sorts of larcenies, including robbery, then perhaps that's something to be explored in greater detail.
Dr. Mistal, we have a couple questions.
Yes, sure.
Representative Costello.
Thank you, Dr. Mistal. So my question actually dovetails with Representative Mina's earlier question related to how crime rates track with economic downturn or uptick, and just really curious about that because I think as we look at these, you know, graphs, what comes to mind to me is what else is happening in society that could help shed light on what we're seeing in the graph.
Sure. Through the chair, I think it's plausible to make a linkage in general conceptual terms between the economic health of a particular community, or in this case, state, and crime. What I would say is I think it's really important to, and this is why disaggregation is important, is to think through what crimes you're talking about, because different crimes have different causes and etiologies and sort of structures that help us understand what we might do to prevent them. And so thinking through the mechanism, right? So if you think through, just as an example, if you think through an economic downturn and sort of what that means in everyday people's lives, well, one thing that it might mean is that you see an uptick in unemployment, just as an example. And that might be hypothesized to be a dynamic that influences both property crime and violent crime, depending on your perspective. And so it could be that it impacts violent crimes, just as an example, because that is a tremendous stressor, right? And so if we think through, for example, how stress influences human behavior, then we might hypothesize some sort of causal sequence in which elevated levels of stress and perhaps unemployment, either long-term or short-term, directly influences rates of violence within a community, or perhaps indirectly through turning to substances like alcohol and drugs, which in turn have a more proximal effect on crime, violent crime. Conversely, right, there are hypotheses that could be put out there that at least on their face seem reasonable. With an economic downturn, and using the example of unemployment again, that acquisitive crimes, right, the appropriation of another person's property may be more likely to occur in the aggregate at the population level when people's means to acquire them legitimately are reduced or eliminated. Those are perfectly plausible hypotheses. What I'm unable to tell you today is I don't have the data to rigorously test those. But research tells us that it's really important to pay attention to the specific, particularly for prevention purposes, what specific dynamics are being hypothesized to produce the result, rather than just taking two population level metrics, correlating them, and inferring direct causation. Let's think about what that might mean. So on the one hand, you have economic downturn. Well, what are we really talking about? You know, it could be that state-level GDP really doesn't manifest itself in individual behavior, but unemployment does. Conversely, thinking about crime. Well, crime's a big thing, and as we're already learning in this presentation, it's multifaceted and complex. And so we need to talk about what kind of crime are we talking about, and then what would be the specific economic dynamic or engine that would be responsible for explaining or accounting for, you know, at least a significant portion of variability that we see.
Hey, thanks, Dr. Mirstall, for that answer. I'm just going to say for the group that there is an economist at ICER named Brett Watson who published a paper in 2020 about the economy in Alaska, including the PFD and its effect on certain types of crime. We will have him come and present on the economy, the PFD, and its effect on crime trends in Alaska at another hearing. So it sounds like we're very interested in the way our economy affects certain types of crime. So we will have him come and speak. And we'll now go to Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, I know we were just talking about causal factors. And so to be a bit more specific, the UCR data is limited by what is reported to the police. And we know that with sexual assault, there's so many cases that aren't reported by the police. I'm wondering if you've looked into the improved ability to report assaults, such as with processing sexual examination kits, and how that has affected increase or decreases in assaults?
Thank you for the question. I have not seen data that would allow sort of a direct examination of those in terms of the things you mentioned. What I would say is that I know, and not to get ahead in the presentation, but with respect to sexual violence in particular, it's 2025. We're in the process of working with the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault to get ready for this this year's fielding of that study. And one of the things that, you know, I think we're pretty committed to doing is improving how we attempt to measure reporting of various forms of violence committed against Alaskan women to police. I think that's the best way to get at that to get the information for people who experience different forms of sexual violence, intimate partner violence, and stalking, and then asking them about whether or not incidents were reported to police. I think at the end of the day, what the research, even here in Alaska, by my colleague Dr. Ingrid Johnson and some of her other work has revealed is that that victims and survivors of violence often disclose. They just don't disclose to official systems, and they disclose to informal networks, friends, family, and other sources of emotional and social support. And anytime we're relying on sort of agency data, whether it's UCR data from the police or other sort of administrative data sets, I think we're always going to be up against against that phenomenon where there's much more happening than sort of official systems are able to capture.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. And last but not least, at the bottom of this slide, we see the criminal homicide rate, which is yet again on a completely different scale than rape and robbery. It is, thankfully, a very low prevalence phenomenon, certainly relative to other violent crimes. But in general, that trend is also a flat trend. But of course, there's variability, year-to-year variability. So what do we make of Alaska's crime picture now that we've looked not only at composites, but broken things out specifically within property crime and violent crime? Again, as I mentioned before, it's important to understand the property crime rate is driven primarily, though not exclusively, by larceny theft. And it's important to understand that all three specific property crimes declined since 1985. So we are definitely trending in the right direction, and it really does seem to be good news with respect to to property crime. The story is different for violent crime, again, driven almost entirely by aggravated assault. But what we see in violent crime is what I referred to before in terms of different dynamics between different crime categories, suggesting that they have different causal and correlational structures. So aggravated assault is up over 66% during this period. So that is not good news. Robbery is down, not hugely, but down. And even rape, despite the hump we saw, even after post 2013 definitional change, is down between over the last decade, about 4%. So between 2013 and 2023. And then criminal homicide is down about a quarter compared to where the state was in 1985. Overall, though, right, when we think about the violent crime rate, again, driven primarily by aggravated assault, is we see this persistent flat trend, especially since 2000, 2001. So that's history, right? And this is the utility of the UCR. We can really take the long view, not be overly myopic and just focused on what's happening today. Nevertheless, I expect you and others want to know, well, let's take a deeper dive into where we are today and how does that compare? So that's what this table is designed to convey. So what we have on the left side of the table are the property crime composite, and then the three specific crimes comprising it. Then we have the violent crime composite and the four crimes that comprise that. In the first data column, you have that rate per 100,000 for the state of Alaska. And in all of this is in 2023. This is the most recent data that we have. The second data column is the crime rate for each of those categories for the United States as a whole. And then the third category is a comparison of Alaska to the United States. So on the top row where you have the property composite, Alaska's rate of 1,619.9 per 100,000 per year is just 84.5% of the United States property crime rate. And I've denoted that in green here is that we're lower than the national rate. Motor vehicle theft, larceny theft, we're basically on par, almost identical. Motor vehicle theft, we're doing better than the United States as a whole. The motor vehicle theft rate of 268.2 per 100,000 per year is just 84.2% of the United States rate. And then burglary, in similar fashion to larceny theft, Alaska's burglary rate is essentially on par with the national rate. It's a very different picture when it comes to violent crime in Alaska. Whether we're looking at the violent crime composite or the four offense categories that comprise it, Alaska is exceptional in, and I don't mean in a good way. Overall, the violent crime composite in Alaska tells us that there are 1,975.2 per 100,000 per year, compared to the United States, which has 363.8 per 100,000 per year. Alaska's violent crime composite rate is 542.9% higher than the national rate. Aggravated assault, which dominates violent crime, Alaska's rate is 1,770.4 per 100,000 per year. That is 670.2% higher than the national rate.
Can I pause you and there?
We can...
Dr.
Marcel, you may. Thank you.
So, Dr. Marcel, that's like such an astounding number. There's just so much more aggravated assault than in the rest of the country. Do you know what types of aggravated assault are most common? I mean, I'm sure that it's probably all of them are higher, but I mean, is this an astronomically higher domestic violence? Is this bar fights? Like, what is the aggravated assaults that we're seeing that's just so much higher than the rest of the country?
Thank you for the question. What I would say is the data that are published does not break out what sort of specific statutory, like we don't have a reverse translation table where we can look at the specific components of UCR aggravated assault category. What we are able to work with is simply the count, and then we calculate rates of aggravated assaults as reported in Crime in Alaska, which is the publication put out by the Department of Public Safety. What I will say, though, is moving forward, we'll be able to have much better information, detailed information, once the state fully converts to NIBRS, which is the National Incident-Based Reporting System, which is, you might think of as the new UCR. DPS, the troopers, and other state agencies are already in NIBRS, the big one, and I was hopeful, and maybe they've turned the switch on, is the Anchorage Police Department. So once we have adequate coverage, that is the percentage of the population that is policed by agencies who participate in NIBRS, we'll be able to answer precisely those sorts of questions. Unfortunately, with the summary data that we currently work with, I cannot.
Okay. Please continue.
And then we can go right down the list. So we talked about aggravated assault, rape, and robbery. Robbery is 116.4% higher, and then criminal homicide is 133.3% higher. So in general, I think one of the big stories here is based on what we know from the uniform crime report data, which are only crimes reported to police, it's not just one category of crime that's higher. It's all of them, although some are exceptionally, alarmingly high. But it's violence in general. And I've said to my colleagues here, the unwritten book is, could be tied, the working title could be Alaska: Violent Land. I think there's so much work to be done examining the dimensions of Alaska's violent crime challenges.
Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, I have a question about the information here. I'm looking at the property composite rates and the violent composite rates, and one of the things I really like to do is I'd like to see a statistical test of significance. And, you know, I mean, I would say the violent composite compared in Alaska compared to the nation is probably statistically significant. I can't say the same about the property composite. So, you know, the issues I have sometimes with statistics is I'd like to see statistical tests of significance. And do you provide those, or is that analysis done to these kinds of statistics?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, it's not theoretically, it's possible if we were to go to the National Archive of Criminal Justice Data and download the data that are archived there. So the UCR data is eventually archived there, because what you would need if you're doing state level analyses, you'd want data for every year for every state and territory, so that you could calculate variances, standard errors, and then whether or not you have a statistically significant difference. I love the question, though. These data have not been statistically tested for difference. What I would say, and I think you're exactly on cue here, and I just tried to highlight like some shading of good news and the neutral, and then things we might want to pay attention to. I would say I would agree with you in property crime. It's probably not so big of a difference to conclude that it's significantly different. In violent crime, I feel quite confident that aggravated assault and rape would pop at a very high level. Probably more questionable with robbery and criminal homicide rates. So that's a perfectly fair question, and I appreciate it. But we would have to do access some different data and then run those analyses. We can do that, though, if the data are available.
Thank you, Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, do you do any geographic breakdowns of the UCR data, and do you do it by municipality or borough?
Through the chair, thank you for that question. Another excellent question. This is another limitation of Alaska's UCR. And it's not to cast blame or aspersions on anyone. It just is what it is. We don't. We could for some. So Anchorage definitely participates in the UCR, and Anchorage-specific analyses could be run. And I've done that in the past. Juneau, maybe. Where it gets tough is that the Alaska State Troopers report as an agency. That complicates things greatly in the summary UCR data, because as we know, the troopers are throughout the state in different regions with different contextual features that are important for understanding crime. And then in addition, even to road system communities, many rely heavily within their communities on the troopers to conduct those investigations. So you think about the Mat-Su, or even Fairbanks, is the extent to which, yes, there are different jurisdictions, but do the jurisdictions partner and collaborate and cooperate with one another, where it's really hard to discern specific, say, a city or borough data from the Alaska trooper data, and then how do you partition those trooper data? So it becomes very difficult once you get outside of Anchorage to compute these rates. It's not necessarily impossible, but it's very difficult.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Dr. Mistral. We really appreciate your presentation. Does your data track the use of alcohol as it pertains to any of these crimes, specifically the violent crimes, the prevalence of alcohol use?
Through the chair, not these specific data, but other work that I've done, I'm sure it will come as no surprise that alcohol is very prevalent in violent crimes that are known to police. So detailed case file review work that I've conducted in the past certainly makes that clear, although it's highly variable from community to community. And oftentimes what I've found is the extent to which alcohol or drug use is at least reported by officers in their narratives as being involved, it may not be as high as some people think. So, but it is certainly not uncommon, for sure, to see alcohol and illicit drug use being present in violent crime incidents that are reported to police.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Mistral, have you seen the Department of Public Safety's annual report where they break down these crimes by region, which I think Representative Mina was asking? I don't know if you've seen it or not, but they do a regional UCR report by their detachments, you know, A, B, C, D, and E detachment, and they break down these crimes and kind of in all these categories.
Through the chair, I have a familiarity with those. I guess I didn't understand that was a statewide UCR breakdown. I misunderstood and thought that those were simply detachment reports. So the volume of work being done by those detachments, I did not know that they also included other LEAs that would have been included in that geographic catchment.
Yes, I don't know if it's all the LEAs. They do kind of coordinate the reporting for them. You're right about that. But I do know in their annual report, they try to break it down geographically, which could be helpful to the Justice Center.
Right.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, for sure. Thank you. Through the chair.
Please continue.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so if we bring all this together, what can we discern? Again, property crime, we can feel pretty confident that we're in a pretty good place. It's a downward trend. We're tracking national property crime rates, and that seems to be good news. That's not to say that things can't be improved, but we're in a pretty good place statewide. Violent crime, on the other hand, it really is not good news. We see persistently high rates of violent crime, especially since 2000-2001. A flat trend, and abnormally high rates in two of the four violent crimes as recently as 2023. Aggravated assault, 6.7 times higher than the national rate, rape, 3.1 times higher, and then robbery and criminal homicide, 1.2 and 1.3 times higher, respectively. I would submit to the committee these are compelling temporal and comparative patterns in these data, and it could very well be that they present more questions than answers. Such is often the nature of criminological data. I do, however, right, I'm hesitant to ever sort of be overly simplistic in my analyses, but I do think the data presented so far, even with limitations of the data inherent within the UCR program, it suggests that Alaska's crime problem is really a violent crime problem. But with that being said, it is important to note that we're talking about seven crimes that are captured by the police. There are many other crimes, and there are some data available through the UCR program, what are called Part 2 offenses, that can be analyzed to help unpack this more. But certainly, the indicators from the Part 1 crime data over time is that if you want to understand crime in Alaska, you might want to look at violent crime first. So some quick caveats, and I want to lead here first and foremost by the concept of the dark figure of crime. And the dark figure of crime refers to the amount of crime that occurs but that is never reported to the police or any other institutional or legal entity. And so what we know is that a lot of crime occurs, and it's never captured, therefore, in the UCR data. And to demonstrate this is the table on the right-hand side of this slide. These are data from the National Crime Victimization Survey, which is a national crime victimization survey conducted by the United States Department of Justice Bureau of Justice Statistics. On the left-hand side of the table, what you'll see are various crime victimization types that map onto UCR crime categories. So we have a violent crime composite. Under that, we have aggravated assault, robbery, and then rape slash sexual assault, followed by a property crime composite, burglary, motor vehicle theft, and other theft, which can be sort of transposed onto larceny theft as defined in the UCR. The data column is the percent of victimizations within each of those crime categories that were reported to police. And this is told to us by victims of crime themselves. So overall, only 50.6% of violent crimes are ever reported to police. 57.1%, a bit higher than that composite, of aggravated assaults are reported to police. 42.4% of robberies and 46% of rapes and sexual assaults. Property crime are significantly experiencing significantly lower reporting rates to the police. 29.9% of the property crime composite were reported to police. 4 out of 10 burglaries, 7 out of 10 motor vehicle thefts, and just 1 out of every 4 other kinds of theft. And what this tells us is, at best, we're getting less than half of the crime that actually occurs in our communities if we rely on the UCR data to estimate prevalence, which is the amount of crime that's actually happening. So this is something to make note of. It's really important. The other thing I would I think is worth mentioning, and there's lots of caveats, I'm just going to name two here. The second is that what is referred to as the hierarchy rule in the summary UCR program. And those on this committee are likely well aware that criminal events are usually bundles of offenses. That is, when somebody is arrested for a crime, it's not, you know, it's not that it never happens, but typically there's more than one criminal offense for which a person is arrested and subsequently charged. So they're bundles of offenses. But the UCR captures only the single most serious crime in any incident. And so if you have a multiple offense criminal event, only one of those is going to be captured within the framework of the UCR summary crime reporting system. What this means is that the UCR isn't really well suited for measuring prevalence. But what I will tell you is it works pretty well for trend analyses, which is what we've spent the first part of today's hearing talking about. It allows us to take the long view. So you might ask, hey, Dr. Merstel, given the caveats you just identified, the dark figure of crime and the hierarchy rule, how could it be useful for helping us understand trends? And the answer is to that question is that there's uniformity in what we would refer to as in the measurement error. So those problems that exist in the UCR data exist for all jurisdictions, and they really haven't changed over time. So we can attribute fluctuations over time to changes in the volume of crime, even if we have a poor measure of overall prevalence. So we're sort of holding that error constant over time. Things are being measured the same way year after year after year after year after year by department after department after department. So it does help us understand how, with respect to seeing changes, the up or down aspects of crime rates. But victimization surveys like the NCVS aren't perfect, but they are a significant improvement in allowing us to get victimization estimates. The NCVS is a world-class, state-of-the-art crime victimization survey, but one of its biggest limitations is that doesn't necessarily help Alaska to know a national crime rate. So the NCVS does not provide states with state-level estimates in general, let alone for specific crimes or sub-state jurisdictions, let's say regions. So what I would suggest to you today is that within these discussions of Alaska crime rate trends, it is my view that Alaska would benefit greatly from a statewide comprehensive NCVS-type victimization survey. I think many of the excellent questions the committee has asked today could be directly answered in the sort of data, detailed data that victimization surveys gather. So I'll just pause here and see if there are any questions before I dive into the Alaska Victimization Survey.
No questions. Please proceed.
Here, Okay, hearing none. To demonstrate what it is that I'm talking about and to give you an update on how Alaska is doing with respect to violence against women in general and sexual violence in particular, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Alaska Victimization Survey. It was launched in 2010 in a partnership with the UAA Justice Center and the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And we've conducted statewide surveys in 2010, 2015, and 2020. So I'm going to be presenting data from the statewide survey, victimization surveys for you today. And I want to walk you through sort of a scenario or an example and demonstrate to you what can be gained by adopting a victimization survey framework to in order to better understand crime. So as an example, in 2020, Alaska's UCR program recorded 1,135 rapes to police, right? So 1,135 rapes were reported to police, and police subsequently recorded those within the UCR program. Also in 2020, there's a supplemental report issued by the Alaska Department of Public Safety called the Felony Sex Offense Report. And it's a separate data collection that the legislature directed DPS to do and analyses. And in that same year, they recorded 1,363 sex offense incidents. Now, please note that sex offense incidents is not limited to the UCR definition of rape. And therefore, it is unsurprising to discover that the sex offense incident count exceeds that of the UCR rape count. Among those 1,363 sex offense incidents documented in the 2020 Felony Sex Offense Report, there were 1,309 victims identified. And nearly 90% of those, or 1,166, were female. But based, as I just discussed, based on national data, we know that a majority of rapes and sexual assault victimizations go unreported to police. So we don't really know how many appear, you know, from those data, we don't really know how many people experienced rape or sexual assault in Alaska in 2020 or any year if we solely rely on UCR data. What I would submit to the committee is that this dark figure of crime makes it very difficult to provide services to survivors of rape and sexual assault, to design and implement sexual assault prevention initiatives, to develop and deliver appropriate offender accountability measures, and more. How do we do that if we don't know the magnitude of the population that needs to be served, who they are, and what was the nature and circumstances of their victimization? So what was it was decided? It was realized back in 2010 that what was needed was a victimization survey that was specifically designed to provide estimates of victimization prevalence. That is, specifically designed to provide an estimate of the number of people, the number of Alaskans who experience rape and/or sexual assault. Very quickly. For those who may be unfamiliar, a quick overview of the ABS methodology. It is a telephonic survey in all three iterations for that I'm reporting on today, both cell phones and landlines. It is limited to adult English-speaking, non-institutionalized women. It's important to note that the ABS uses behaviorally specific questions. And this is important because it doesn't require respondents to define their experiences as a crime. A victim need not know what the criminal law is. All they need to be able to do is share their experiences. Survey results are weighted by us here at the Justice Center to correct for non-response and various forms of sampling error. And therefore, we are able to provide victimization prevalence estimates, that is, the percentage of the population for three specific types of violence committed against Alaskan women: intimate partner violence, sexual violence, and stalking. Estimates are computed both for past year experiences as well as lifetime victimization experiences. And to date, we are very thankful and humbled by the nearly 13 1,000 Alaskan women who have participated and shared their experiences with us. So what does the ABS tell us about past year or past 12-month victimization? Let me orient you to this table. On the left side of the table, you have two broad categories of violence, intimate partner violence and sexual violence. The intimate partner violence consists of two subtypes, threats of physical violence and actual acts of physical violence. And sexual violence also includes two subcategories, alcohol or drug-involved sexual assault and forcible sexual assault. And then at the bottom is an overall composite that is inclusive of all of those. So the percentage of adult women in Alaska who respond in the affirmative to intimate partner violence, sexual violence, or both. And once again, I would just refer committee members to the appendices included at the end of this presentation to understand the specific measures that are used in the development of these estimates. So I'm just going to focus on 2020. And so we'll read the column from top to bottom. Overall, in 2020, we estimate that 6.9% of adult Alaskan women experienced one or more incidents of intimate partner violence. Breaking that out into the two subcategories, we estimate 2.6% of adult Alaskan women experienced threats of violence, and 6.5% experienced physical violence at the hands of intimate and or sexual partners. With respect to sexual violence, the composite, 3.4% of adult Alaska women experienced in the past year at least one incidence of sexual violence. 2.1% experienced alcohol or drug-involved sexual assault, and 2.2% experience one or more episodes or incidents of forcible sexual assault. Translating these numbers into the numbers of Alaskans who experience these things. In 2020, an estimated 18,314 adult Alaskan women experienced one or more incidents of intimate partner violence. 8,791 experienced one or more incidents of sexual violence, inclusive of alcohol or drug-involved sexual assault and or forcible sexual assault, 5,712. This is the sort of knowledge and information we can glean from victimization surveys. We can translate prevalence estimates into the number of Alaskans harmed, and of course, then begin to make much more solid inferences about the impact on communities, as well as to survivors and their families. So to just wrap up this comparison, keeping in mind the 2020 frame that I established for you at the beginning of this section of the presentation. In 2020, the felony sex offense report identified 525 adult women as victims of qualifying sexual offenses. That same year, the ABS revealed an estimate of 8,791 adult women who experienced sexual violence that year. This is a big difference, 525 versus 8,791, and it is not a small difference. I have not tested it statistically, but it is significant. It is huge. It is an order of, by order of magnitude, the difference in the prevalence when we rely on administrative data sets versus a victimization survey. So I just wanted to provide this example to help the committee and sort of make tangible the benefits of considering perhaps a different approach to studying and understanding crime in Alaska. And with that, I'll be happy to answer additional questions. And thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Dr. Mistal. I do have a question. So for this survey, and you and I have talked about this before, the fact that it does not include incarcerated women, do you know why?
Well, the objective was, the objective of the survey is they were just, is your question is why were they
excluded?
Intentionally excluded?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think from a methodological and cost standpoint, even though, you know, you think of the women who are incarcerated in DOC as being a relatively small number of people, it would require a completely different methodology, and it would be a pretty expensive thing to do. And given the uniqueness of the population, it'd be hard to grapple with empirically when trying to provide overall population estimates. But it's a combination of, again, not any one thing. I certainly don't think that it was any sense of women who are incarcerated's voice isn't valued. I think everybody within the council, certainly here in the Justice Center and others who spend any time in this area, service providers throughout the state, know that rates of violent victimization among the incarcerated population exceed by some margin those of the general population. It just creates some significant methodological challenges.
Thank you. Are there any questions
from
the committee? Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, I saw this survey has been done every 5 years, 2010, 2015, 2020. So that begs the question, is that survey going to happen this year, 2025, for additional data?
Through the chair, it is. We're working with CDBSA now to get everything in place and begin the real work of revisions to the instrument as the council deems necessary and getting everything ready to go to launch.
Follow up. When might that report on the 2025 data be released? What's a projection, please?
Through the chair, I would project that to be probably a summer of 2026. To fall of 2026, so that the data collection takes about 6 months to acquire the necessary sample, and then once we work through data cleaning and weighting processes, get to analyses, it's probably another 4 to 6 months following.
Any other questions? I have one more, Dr. Mistal. Is there any other state,
sure.
I mean, any other state that's ever had violent crime rates as high as ours?
I cannot answer that question today. If there's ever been a state with a crime rate higher, are you talking about the total crime rate or a specific crime rate?
Well, I was going to ask if there'd ever been in history a state with violent crime as high as ours, and if it went down, what did they do? Basically sort of searching for, is there some sort of strategy that another state has used to reduce their violent crime rate? Since our crime rate is very high and stays there, what's someone who's had this exact same problem done to solve it is the question.
That's a great question. What I would say is sort of coming back to what I mentioned before is thinking through specific mechanisms of what's going on and not lumping all crime together. Probably the most prominent example with respect to violent crime is that's in the literature and is what are referred to as focused deterrence strategies. And the most famous probably being the Boston Ceasefire Project that dealt with gangland gun violence, which was tearing Boston apart again in about the mid-1990s. And that was less of a policy change out of a legislature and more of a different approach and partnership with state, local, and federal law enforcement. And I won't get into the deep weeds of that, but we know, for example, that not all criminals offend at the same rate. We have high rate offenders, and we have low rate sporadic offenders, and we have people who are one-offs. And we want to direct resources, whether it's police resources or judicial or prosecutorial resources, where we can get the biggest bang for our buck as a community, right? And so that that leads us to focus on high rate offenders. So the first thing we need to know is who's doing what. Then we need to know how often they're doing it. And then develop proactive policing and prosecutorial strategies to target those folks. But importantly, within the CSPIRE project and what and other replications that were done in the United States, is it was not just a stick, it was a carrot and stick approach. When folks were identified, they were proactively brought in before they were arrested by their probation officers and told that law enforcement knew who they were, what they've likely been up to, and told them not to do that, otherwise they would experience the full weight of the law. At the same time, community service providers were brought in to that same meeting and said, this is the alternative. If you don't commit crime, there's all these positive resources, community and social supports that can be provided to you. The choice is yours. I'm grossly overgeneralizing the very subtle details of that initiative. They had remarkable success in decreasing not only gun-specific crimes in Boston, but violent crime in general. As it turns out, when you remove the highest rate violent crime offenders, and when that's coupled with providing people with positive alternatives to crime, you can have tremendous effects. So that would be one example of beginning with data and then thinking through a problem-solving, problem-oriented approach, where you collect data, you develop an approach, and you continually evaluate throughout the process to see how you're doing.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Seeing no further questions, Dr. Bradley Myrstal, thank you so much for your presentation today. We appreciate it. And
you're very welcome.
Thanks. That concludes today's business before the House Judiciary Committee. Looking ahead to next week, on Monday, we will have a confirmation hearing for appointees to the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics, followed by the first hearing of House Bill 101, Crimes Against Minors, sponsored by myself, Rep. Gray. On Wednesday at 1:30 p.m., House Judiciary will be meeting with the Senate Judiciary Committee in the Davis Room, 106, to hear a presentation from Ken Sanchagrin, the Executive Director of Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. That same day, following that joint committee, we will reconvene in the Grunberg at 3 p.m. to have a hearing on immigration in Alaska by the American Civil Liberties Union, Alaska Institute of Justice, Alaska Literacy Project, Catholic Social Services, and Project Alaska. And then on Friday, we will be hearing House Bill 77, Mail Theft, sponsored by Representative Colomb. The time is now 2:49 p.m., and this hearing of the House Judiciary Committee is adjourned.